This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Stamp. You can go to our website to read a section of the book and to read my column, Rosa Parks, Now and Forever. If you'd like a copy of today's show, go to our website at democracynow.org. Happy birthday, Hugh Grant. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Radio is proud to help sponsor Threshold, Black Water Snake, a benefit for the Oregon Acupuncture and Naturopathic Associations. Saturday, February 9th, from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m., will be a Chinese New Year party, and Sunday, February 10th, from 6 to 10 p.m., will be a benefit auction fundraiser. Both events will be held at Refuge PDX, 116 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. The Blackwater Snake is intuitive, a socially adventurous spirit that loves taking risks. The theme encourages discovery of balance in the feminine and masculine energies within ourselves, our relationships, our communities, and the world at large. More information can be found at kboo.fm/threshold2013.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Portland premiere of Who Bombed Judy Berry at the Clinton Street Theater, Wednesday, February 13th. The film will play at both 7 p.m. and 9:15. This new documentary covers the 1990 bomb attack on two Northern California environmental activists, which still remains unsolved. The film is a compelling tribute to Berry, a fiery speaker whose background as a union organizer put her in a unique position to bridge the cultural divide between forest activists and rank-and-file loggers.
I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe.
Again, that's Wednesday, February 13th at the Clinton Street Theater. More information may be found at kboo.fm/Berry2013.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear about a rally this morning in Salem calling for health care for all in Oregon, and an upcoming action opposing a water bottling plant in the Columbia River Gorge.
The protests continue against the Keystone XL pipeline with the lockdown in Oklahoma.
And we'll speak with one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit Hedge versus Obama, which challenges the Obama administration policy allowing indefinite detention without charge. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 4th, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Angelique O'Rourke. A local branch of the group Food and Water Watch is planning an action in Portland this Friday to oppose Nestle's plan to construct a water bottling plant in the Columbia Gorge. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Julia DeGraw, who is helping to organize the campaign opposing the bottling plant.
What are Nestle's plans in the Columbia River Gorge?
Nestle is a multinational corporation that is interested in coming into the Columbia River Gorge and bottling spring water that is snowmelt from Mount Hood. They want to open up a water bottling facility in the town of Cascade Locks, Oregon, and bottle their municipal water under their Pure Life brand and bottle spring water under their Arrowhead brand. In order for that project to move forward, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife would have to go through this kind of complicated water exchange process so that publicly owned water could be given away so that Nestle could then bottle and sell it for its profit. So we're actually calling on the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, as well as the governor of Oregon, Governor Kitzhaber, to put a stop to this project. We're asking the Department of Fish and Wildlife not to proceed with that water exchange process that would allow Nestle to bottle publicly owned water resources. So we oppose Nestle, especially because in America, Nestle is one of the worst players in the bottled water industry, and it's possible to stop these water bottling facilities from being built, whereas it's really hard to shut them down once they've been opened. So we are fighting to keep any Nestle water bottling facility from being built anywhere in the Northwest. And it just happens that Cascade Locks is where Nestle has really gained a foothold. And Nestle has a record of going into rural communities that have been hit with difficult economic times and overpromising on jobs and underemphasizing the potential environmental impacts of what they're going to be doing. And that's kind of how they take advantage of these rural communities to open up water bottling facilities.
Now, when you say that Nestle is one of the worst players in the U.S., are you talking about just that they go in and promise more jobs than they actually provide, or are there other issues that Nestle has had in the past?
Well, Nestle has a large track record in many communities in Florida, in Maine, and in Michigan, and probably other places as well, in damaging local water resources. In Michigan specifically, in McCosta County, Michigan, their overdrawal of groundwater caused springs to go dry. This community had a drought, and Nestle continued to pump millions and millions of gallons of water out of this groundwater system. And people's wells went dry, springs went dry, there were fish die-offs. And when the community sued to limit Nestle's pumping, they actually won in a lower court, but Nestle, of course, appealed that decision and asked for an exemption so it could continue pumping during this drought, and they were granted that exemption.
I understand you have an event coming up this Friday.
We're planning on having a group of people get together in at the entrance of Lower McClahey Park, which is at Northwest Upshur and just past 29th, where we're going to be doing a really fun aerial, we're calling it an aerial flash art mob. So we're basically going to be asking people to wear all red or wear as much red as you possibly can, and we're going to form a really great kind of human X through a big Nestle logo and use all of the pictures and whatever film we get from this event for doing a big social media push and raising the visibility of this event.
Again, I've been speaking with Julia DeGraw with Food and Water Watch here in Portland. Their website, foodandwaterwatch.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Tina Kotek, the new Speaker of the Oregon House of Representatives, spoke out at a town hall meeting this weekend in favor of coal export terminals on the Oregon coast. Her announcement angered many constituents who had come to the town hall meeting to speak in opposition to the terminals. There are three terminals proposed for the Oregon coast that would export coal mined in Montana and Idaho and then shipped by train across the state. Here are the voices of residents of the Columbia River Gorge speaking at a recent protest against the coal terminals.
We've already stopped one of them, right? We've stopped the one in Grays Harbor. And so this is just beginning. You know, James Hansen, the great NASA climatologist, has said that coal is the biggest threat to life on Earth. And we're ground zero. This is the exports that they want to bring through the Northwest will do just irreparable harm to, not just to the communities here, as they will, but to the planet as a whole. And so this is our responsibility. I don't want to be melodramatic, but this is our historic responsibility that we have to stop coal exports coming through our neighborhoods.
2 weeks ago, I found out, I got some information on the coal, wanting to run 8 trains through the back of my neighborhood. And I've been a resident here for over 20 years. I've got a double lot. I cannot wrap my head around the fact that I won't be able to grow food in my own yard. I just cannot. I've never been political. I've never called my representatives. But on this issue, is bringing me out, and it's getting me stirred up. And it's very easy to call your representative. I found that out. And I'm just very passionate about this. And it's great to see all my neighbors out here. And this is my issue.
Yeah, I'm here because I see the coal train proposal. And the possibility of the coal trains as, you know, one of many assaults on the treaty rights of Northwest tribes. It's going to have an incredibly damaging effect on the ecosystems of the Columbia River, on the salmon runs. It's also going to interfere with people's ability to fish in their usual and accustomed places. I'm strongly opposed to the coal train because I believe that it's going to create a kind of mono economy. All the arguments about the economic development and jobs coming to the region, I think, are completely specious. I think instead what we're going to see is capital flight. We're going to see, people who can move out of the region and take their jobs out of the region. There's going to be a lot of capital flight and job flight, I think, if this these multiple proposals go through.
Those were protesters at a recent demonstration challenging the proposal to construct coal export terminals on the Oregon coast. They are encouraging people to call the Speaker of the House, or Speaker of Oregon House, Tina Kotek, to challenge her recently announced support of the proposed coal terminals.
In Oregon City, sea lions heading up to Willamette Falls from California are facing a hazing crew, a group of seven people hired by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to drive them away. The project, which is in its third year, will last 3 months starting today and is aimed at driving sea lions away from the fishing ladders for winter steelhead and spring chinook, both listed as threatened species. 7 days a week, the hazing crew will use cracker shells and underwater explosives to cause loud sounds designed to frighten the animals away from the area between Willamette Falls and the I-205 bridge. The explosives are designed to be a humane method that will not harm the sea lions, which are a federally protected animals. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is authorized under House Bill 3255 to spend money generated from hunting and fishing licenses to fund this project. Residents near to the area can expect to hear distant, loud booms during the duration of the project.
A hospital official for Oregon Health and Science University commented that an Eastern Oregon teenager who tried to commit suicide at a school playground has died. 15-year-old Jaden Bell attempted to hang himself on January 19th at an elementary school playground in La Grande, about 250 miles east of Portland. Family friend Bud Hill told the Oregonian newspaper earlier this week that the boy's family had always been supportive of his sexual orientation, but some classmates called him names and had complained about bullying to a school counselor. Bell was a high school sophomore at La Grande High School.
Around 1,000 Oregonians gathered at the state capitol in Salem this morning to demand health care for all in the state of Oregon. The rally came on the opening day of this year's session of the Oregon State Legislature. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was there and filed this report.
This is Jamie Partridge with the KBOO News. I'm standing here on the Capitol steps in Salem. And I've got Peter Shapiro here, who is... What's your official position, Peter?
I'm the chair of the Healthcare Committee of Portland Jobs with Justice, and I'm on the Organizational Development Committee of Healthcare for All Oregon, which is the statewide coalition that we belong to.
And what's going on here today, Peter?
Well, we're here to let the state legislature know on their opening day that we expect them to do something serious about the health care crisis during this session. Specifically, we want them to give serious consideration to Michael Dembrough's bill, the Affordable Health Care for All Oregon Act, which would basically create a single-payer system here in Oregon where health care would be publicly funded. And it would everybody who lives or works in Oregon would have access to care.
What kind of support does his bill have at this point?
Actually, a lot more than it had 2 years ago when the bill was introduced. We could have as many as 22 co-sponsors this time around. We're still Representative Dembrough is still collecting names. But I went to a town hall meeting in Multnomah Village in Portland last week. It was a packed house and. It looked like just about everybody in the room was sympathetic to what we were doing, and two of the three legislators who were up on the podium said they were going to sign on to the bill, or they expected to. In fact, one of them is speaking at the rally today, Jennifer Williamson. She ran in the Democratic primary. She campaigned basically on the idea of a single-payer health care system, and she's going to be one of our strongest advocates, I think. She won handily in that election, so... Public sentiment is there. You know, I think there's a lot of voters who are realizing this is a life and death issue, and we need to make the legislature start taking it seriously.
Can you let our listeners know what the problems are with Obamacare, why a different kind of single-payer bill is necessary?
The big problem with Obamacare is it doesn't control costs. Insurance rates are continuing to skyrocket. They will continue to skyrocket even when the insurance exchanges are set up next year. And I think, as a union man, I should say that the exchanges are going to pose all sorts of problems for union health plans. I was at a workshop at a labor law conference last week where a presentation was made for union health benefits negotiators about how they're going to have to deal with the law. And I never saw a bunch of more anxious-looking people in my life. This is going to make their job far more difficult and far more complicated, and it's going to... A lot of employers, I think, are simply going to try to dump their union plans or cut a lot of their workers down to part-time and push them onto the healthcare exchange, where they will probably not get as high a level of care as they're getting now. That's certainly a big, big problem in the building trades, where people move from job to job, and they count on a multi-employer health plan that the union runs to make sure that they have coverage between jobs. Some of these small contractors are going to move into the exchange, and those multi-employer health plans that protect construction workers are going to be in serious trouble.
I'm 61 years old. In December, it was tough for me. When I went back on the 27th, 2 days after Christmas, they said, Wes, you have to walk through the dark valley, Wes. Wes, you have cancer. For the first time in 41 years, I do not have employment-based insurance. I was a fireman for 16 years. I worked with occupational health and safety for a number of years. And, you know, it's just the way they rolled out. And the bills are coming in, and I just don't have the money to do it. We can do better than that. I'm so proud to be an Oregonian, and I'm proud of who's here today. We are from all over the state of Oregon, and we are diversified. And you know what we have in common? We know as Oregonians that we can change things for the better and take back health care. We know that, don't we?
That was activist Wes Bryan speaking at a rally this morning in Salem, calling on the state legislature to pass a bill that would provide health care to all Oregonians. Two states, Vermont and Montana, currently have single-payer plans to provide health care for all at the state level. California has similar legislation in process.
Whole Foods Market announced today the recall of Lox products in Oregon and Washington due to possible contamination with listeria. These items in Oregon and Washington sold before January 29th are being pulled from the shelves. Cold smoked salmon lox trim, bagels with lox cream cheese and capers, and Gravlox cream cheese spread. Whole Foods has posted signs in its stores regarding the recalls and is offering a full refund. Listeria is a bacteria which causes food poisoning symptoms in healthy adults, but can be extremely dangerous and potentially fatal to children, the elderly, and those with immune problems. It can also cause miscarriages and stillbirths among pregnant women.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30 is Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show features a panel of guests talking on issues concerning Oregon Public Safety Commission's report. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Today's show will celebrate the life and work of Rosa Parks on her 100th birthday, commentary from Bruce Dixon of the Black Agenda Report on the Seattle teacher strike. Tomorrow's weather is a high chance of rain with a high of 48 degrees.
It's 5:20 and time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The powers that be say that the bulk of America's middle-class manufacturing jobs are gone and won't be coming back. High-tech jobs are being outsourced too, as are accountants, lawyers, and some other professional positions. So where does this leave us? Grasping at straws, the most abundant of which are retail jobs. But wait, those aren't jobs, they're jobettes. Part-time, poverty pay, no benefits, lousy schedules, little training, and no advancement opportunity. Most big retail chains treat their employees as nothing but a drain on profits, not an asset to invest in. Salespeople are typically paid only $10 an hour. Clerks get only $9.70, and cashiers just $9. Worse, 94% of retailers define full-time work as only 30 hours a week. People can't make ends meet on that, and America can't have a healthy economy without a solid middle class. Yet 15 million people are in retail work now, and it's to be our second biggest source of new jobs for the next decade. Well, shrug the powers that be, the retail giants must compete on low prices, so they have no choice but to keep cutting corners on their workforce. As we say in Texas, bovine excrement. Look at Trader Joe's, where full-time jobs start at $40,000. Or at Costco, where employee retainment is a priority and 98% of managers are promoted from within. Low-price chains that invest directly in workers are reaping industry highs in performance, morale, customer satisfaction, and profits. Bad jobs are not a retail necessity, just a corporate choice. This is Jim Hightower saying, this week, a Retail Justice Alliance has been launched to push America's employers and policymakers to turn retail jobs into good jobs that spread a middle-class standard of living and rebuild our grassroots economy. Learn more at RetailJusticeAlliance.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
A bipartisan political committee called Respect Arizona has announced that it will begin gathering signatures to trigger a special election for the recall of controversial Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. William James Fisher, the Republican lawyer who started this committee, says that he feels Sheriff Arpaio's hardline stance on immigration reflects negatively on the Arizona Republican Party. Arpaio has responded to these actions in a prepared statement, saying, "I have faith in the people of Maricopa County. They know exactly what and who they want in office." Arpaio fundraised over 80% of his last campaign contributions from out-of-state supporters. Though Arpaio was recently reelected for a sixth term, members of Respect Arizona say they believe the recall has a chance because he won with only 50.7% of the vote. The sheriff has been the subject of scandal for mishandling taxpayer funds, mishandling the investigations of 400 sexual crimes against children, and was also the subject of a Department of Justice investigation over alleged abuse of power, which ended without charges being filed. Currently, he is the subject of two lawsuits from the Department of Justice and the ACLU alleging racial profiling.
A new report by the Huffington Post has counted the number of gun deaths in the U.S. since the massacre at a Newtown, Connecticut elementary school 2 months ago. The number of people killed in just 2 months is close to 1,300, including many people shot during petty quarrels and a number of accidental shootings. Jason Cherkis, who headed the investigation, spoke with HuffPost Live this weekend.
There are many, many different personal stories behind those figures. Everybody remembers this splash on the Huffington Post, where we told personal stories as well. Talk to me a little bit about the reporting that you've done. And, you know, one of the things to me that stuck out was 30 deaths alone by guns on Christmas Day.
What we did basically was it was myself and a number of editors and a couple interns here in D.C., spent the last 7 weeks just tracking every single murder. We divided it up by everyone got states to sort of monitor. And what I found as was sort of shocking about it, if you want to talk about Christmas, which is a lot of accidental shootings on Christmas and just across the 7 weeks. That was one of the sort of surprising things that I found. It's just kids getting hold of guns, not knowing what to do with them, and accidentally either shooting themselves or their relatives, their brothers, their best friends. And one of those incidents is the one I did the most reporting on, where I had interviewed a father who had recently purchased a gun to protect his family. His mobile home, he had thought someone had tried to break into it a couple weeks before Christmas, so he purchased a gun. And on Christmas Day, he had left it unattended and loaded for us, like a split second. Like, he just sort of turned to call his wife, and his two-year-old got a hold of the gun and shot himself by accident in the chest, and he died. And, you know, what the anguish that the father is going through now, and I also had interviewed the son's grandmother is just overwhelming. I think they're both fairly numb to it all.
Another stat, Jason, that I thought was just startling was that in the first week alone after Newtown, there were 100 gun deaths.
Yeah. You know, there was gun deaths that night. I mean, there was multiple shootings on December 14th, and there was a lot of shooting deaths that very weekend. It didn't seem to, the tragedy really did not make a difference in terms of, I don't think there was a pause in shooting or a pause in just sort of gun violence. To me, what was also remarkable was just with the availability of guns and with people having guns around, sort of silly arguments or silly fights became deadly. There was one that we found of an argument over two broken cigarettes that resulted in a murder. There was an argument over a stolen Xbox. There was, a random argument at a taco truck resulted in a murder. I think it's sort of the readily availableness of guns, the lack of training, across the board for those accidental deaths was sort of surprising.
And it just, there's no other way to look at it than guns are everywhere in the United States of America. And it's so important what your reporting has done here to put faces, the faces that we see right now on my computer screen, on the gun violence in America. So Jason Cherkis, thank you so much for being here and thanks so much for your story.
Protests against the Keystone XL pipeline escalated this morning in Norman, Oklahoma, when local resident Elizabeth Leha locked her neck to equipment used in construction, citing concerns for Oklahoma's waterways and their importance for the health of future generations. The Gulf Coast Project is the southern segment of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline, a $7 billion project by multinational TransCanada. It is slated to transport diluted bitumen from Cushing, Oklahoma, through East Texas to refineries in Houston and Port Arthur. The corrosive nature of diluted bitumen makes pipelines prone to leaks, and when spills occur, the heavier diluted bitumen sinks into the water table. The tar sands mining construction, which begins in northern Alberta, is projected as the largest industrial project in the history of humankind. When fully realized, it will have destroyed pristine boreal forest and left a toxic wasteland the size of New York State. Leha is working with a coalition of groups and individuals dedicated to stopping tar sands transportation through the Great Plains region. She stands in solidarity with scores of anti-extraction activists in Texas who have for months used similar tactics to oppose and actively blockade the construction of the pipeline there. Last Thursday, KBOO News reported on a similar incident when a Texas activist chained himself to equipment during a talk given by Tom Hamilton, manager of quality and compliance for TransCanada. Their actions also follow the recent commitment in South Dakota by a number of tribes, indigenous groups, and allies to resist the northern segment of the Keystone XL pipeline through the signing of the International Treaty to Protect the Sacred. The Keystone XL pipeline, as it snakes its way through the heartland of North America, not only crosses numerous major rivers, but the Ogallala Aquifer, which provides drinking and agricultural water for huge sections of the American Midwest. Communities directly impacted by this industry, as well as a growing North American anti-extraction movement, have made halting tar sands transportation by the Keystone XL an international priority.
1 year ago, President Obama signed into law the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, which authorizes warrantless search and seizure, indefinite detention without trial, and the criminalization of free speech in the name of fighting terrorism. Seven people, including journalist Chris Hedges, whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and academic Noam Chomsky, filed a lawsuit to challenge the NDAA. This week, a federal appeals court will hear the Obama administration's appeal of that lawsuit. The president filed the appeal after a judge ruled last May that Section 1021 of the NDAA is, on its face, unconstitutional. For more, we go to KBOO's Jenka Soderberg, who spoke with Jennifer Tangerine Bolin, one of the seven plaintiffs in the lawsuit.
What happens on Wednesday when the judge rules?
We go into court at 10 a.m., probably at 10 a.m. We're in the morning roster, so that could be switched up. But We put a Facebook event up and did this on other social media, and we have almost 800 people saying they're coming. Now, I don't think there will be that many, but it's a courtroom that seats 60, so this is going to be interesting. And what will happen is we'll only be in there for about 45 minutes. We'll find out whether the judges agree with us or the government attorneys, and then we'll proceed from there to a press conference and some pretty big demonstrations. I think there will probably be hundreds of people there. Lots of things are planned for that. And there's a pretty good lineup for the press conference. We've got Cornel West is probably joining us, Thomas Drake, the high-level NSA whistleblower who was threatened with life in prison because he did the right thing, will be there. His colleague, Jesselyn Radak from Government Accountability Project, will be there. And then, of course, our lawyers, Chris Hedges, Daniel Ellsberg, myself, you know, the plaintiffs.
Provision 1021, can you fill our listeners in on what it entails?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So Section 1021, it contravenes both the First and the Fifth Amendments. It completely suspends due process in this nation, so it essentially rolls us back to pre-Magna Carta days, 800 years. And it is a significant and serious threat to the First Amendment. There's a lot behind that, but essentially there's a paragraph in that provision that provides for such broad, sweeping, unchecked, and vague powers that a group of us actually coordinated and conceived of and then coordinated this lawsuit after Chris Hedges filed. And I gathered a group of us together to basically say, wait a minute, you have to define your terms, U.S. government, because all of us are probably in danger under this provision. And sure enough, we won our case.
Now, can you explain what happened after Judge Forrest ruled that the section of the NDAA was unconstitutional, and then the Obama administration filed an appeal?
Yeah, they did. We won a huge ruling. It was the biggest win for civil liberties in at least a decade, if not since the Pentagon Papers, because it is a worldwide injunction against the U.S. government being able to basically detain people at whim without having to provide any evidence and denying you access to any due process. So we won. They immediately appealed, actually in under 24 hours, despite Obama having signed his signing statement last in 2011, or right after in 2012, and saying he didn't want